Welcome everybody to the Evolution Seminar Series. Today we have our invited speaker. He's the director of the Wisconsin Institute of Discovery. He comes from the Santa Fe Institute, and he's gonna give us a talk about some of the things that he's doing at the WIT, which I recently discovered is more than a really cool venue to host outreach events. So I hope he talks about the WIT.
Yeah. All right, let's just go. So I actually wasn't sure what to talk about anyway, and so this works quite well. I'm the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. That's the place where you get your coffee. We are trying to do something a little differently on campus in terms of a sort of non-disciplinary, or I consider it anti-disciplinary, anti-departmental science. And in addition to being the director of that institute, we have a research group there called C4, Explosive Ideas. It's Center for Complexity and Collective Computation. And I was going to talk to you a little bit about some of our work. I'm not sure. So what I was going to do, and I guess I'll get another machine, I'll just introduce some of the ideas, was talk about where we are with respect to evolutionary theory now, in the 21st century, whether it's still viable as a theory, and why it is that biologists are so defensive about a framework that we know is only provisional. Right? So why is it, for example, acceptable in physics to have a series of revolutions that fundamentally challenge your foundations? So think about Einstein in 1905 with special relativity, and then 1916 with general relativity and so on, where he's questioning the foundations of the field. And yet when people challenge the evolutionary edifice, we get defensive, either because we think we're being assaulted by creationists, or some other reason, that we somehow feel as if Darwin's framework represents the kind of summa, the sum total of the intellectual contribution to a framework for biology, which I think is fundamentally flawed as a conception. So I'd be happy to have a discussion about this. So what I was going to do was actually go through what I consider 8 fundamental inconsistencies or weaknesses of the theory that aren't fundamentally undermining it, but that challenge its efficacy at explaining a very large range of phenomena at different scales. So in that sense, what I would like to tell you is it's a bit like classical mechanics that works in some narrow range of values, but in the way that classical mechanics fails at very large scales or at very small scales, when you have to go to general relativity or quantum mechanics, Darwin's theory also has failings that in certain limits it can't explain certain phenomena. Or built into the theory are solutions that will require a slight change in the way we theorize. And so about 1999, I left England and I went to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And I spent most of my life with string theorists. This is an institute that's well known in mathematics and mathematical physics. And so every day I'd come into lunch and I'd sit down with the physicists and they'd say, "What is biology? Should natural selection be predicted from a fundamental law of physics?" In other words, when we have our grand unified theory of the universe, where you can predict the existence of gravity and so forth, will we predict from first principles natural selection? And I don't know the answer to that. I thought, well, I don't know. I don't know what anyone else thinks in this room. In some sense, they feel that if you have a complete theory of everything, then that should at least include the processes that give rise to life as we know it, even if you can't predict the particular forms of life that you observe. Okay? And so that's where I sort of started, and it's actually interesting, that problem for me has been, it's called Paradoxes 2, I think, the tool. So that was my itch, trying to work out whether or not that would be the case. Could I, from a more fundamental principle that wasn't biological, that wasn't Darwinian, having difficulties, derive derived from it, Darwin's theory. Okay. So then I just asked myself the question, you know, what kind of theory is evolutionary biology? So if you read The Origin of Species, there's no equations in that book, right? There's no data in the book. I mean, there's data, qualitative data. It's all text. So here's this thing that purports to be a scientific theory, but it reads more like philosophy. Right? It's a conceptual framework for understanding the world. It doesn't have the canonical properties of what we would consider a scientific approach, that is, experiments, good data, large bodies of data that you can test hypotheses against, in some rigorous fashion, in other words, using statistics, say, or now in the modern sense, use models and mathematics. It's not PowerPoint, it's Keynote. So that was what it was to Darwin, right? In 1859, it was a narrative textual theory. In the beginning of the 20th century, some of it was mathematized. And that became known as population genetics, and many of you are probably familiar with those frameworks. And that's associated with people like Fisher and others. But they only mathematized certain elements of the theory, very simple things. So for example, if you had a few discrete traits and they conferred a certain fitness advantage on an organism, over the course of time, what would be the frequencies of these traits in the population? This is great. This is almost like a joke. And it doesn't matter because the first part of the talk was so qualitative. It really doesn't matter. So that was the first attempt to sort of mathematize it and turn it into a theory. And Fisher actually was really motivated by theories in physics. He wanted fundamental, parsimonious, elegant theory of the kind that a physicist might be interested in. You know, F equals ma, E equals mc squared. Can we write down equations like that for evolution? And he came up with this fundamental theorem of natural selection, which simply said that the strength of selection was proportional to the variance, which seems like a very, very trivial kind of theory, and is actually not even true under most conditions that we know. Okay. A little later, the theory attracted the attention of computer scientists. Right? And they were interested in optimization. So if you're exploring some surface, like a landscape, where you have peaks and troughs, where peaks represent good solutions to problems and troughs bad solutions, natural selection, combined with some mechanism of variation generation, mutation, would be a good optimization framework. Didn't really matter whether it was biological or not. And so engineers borrowed, in some sense, the metaphor of evolution by natural selection as an optimization technique. And that was called genetic algorithms, and many of you might know that. And so in some sense, that fed back into biology, and biologists started to think, well, maybe all natural selection is optimization. And in fact, the right way to think about a theory in the 21st century or the late 20th century of evolution is to recognize that it's just a kind of weird natural computation that's optimizing. So that's quite different, right, from Fisher, who wants to write down this theorem. It's more like an algorithm. Okay. More recently, there have been two extra moves. One is the recognition of something I work on, that the actual equations of evolution turn out to be equivalent to the equations written down in inference, in Bayesian statistics, and the equations written down by learning theorists. So for example, reinforcement conditioning. Oh, right.
Backwards.
Where?
How do you get it the other way around? Everybody gather around the laptop.
If you do mirroring, then you should just have the same on both, in principle.
Yeah, that was.
So there's been this interesting shift that perhaps learning and evolution are in some sense fundamentally mathematically equivalent, but the mechanisms are different. So for example, in evolution you have variants in a population. Some of them are favored by some environmental signal. They tend to increase in frequency, that's natural selection. Whereas in conditioning, reinforcement learning, you have a range of behaviors. Some of those behaviors work, some don't, and through a reinforcement signal, the ones that do well increase in frequency at the expense of the others. Okay. So in that sense, they feel very, very similar. It's just the time scales are different, right? Learning happens with a single individual in a generation. All right, good. And evolution occurs over multiple generations. Just a skip to all that. This question. This is Ed Witten, by the way, he's a very famous string theorist, and he was the one who asked me, should evolution by natural selection be a theory,
the outcome of a theory of physics?
And here's my, see, look, I'm on topic. This is that basic background, what is it? And finally, this return to Fisher, now where a few people are arguing there are actually systematic ways potentially of deriving evolutionary dynamics from more fundamental principles in physics, in particular from a field called non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. So this actually makes our life quite hard, because in explaining to people what evolution is, it's sort of all of these things, right? According to the community you belong to. For some people really are still working in the 19th century tradition. There are probably one or two in this room who still do, I don't know, descriptive evolutionary biology that would not be that unfamiliar to Darwin, right? And there are others who would be very unfamiliar to Darwin, who are writing down these weird physics-like theories to explain the framework itself, okay? Often at the expense of data. Now, so if it is a physical theory, then what are the laws? If there are laws in physics that come out of the theory, like the laws of gravity and Maxwell's equations, so forth, what are they? And it's actually a difficult question to answer, because they're clearly not deterministic laws like gravity, right? It's not that everywhere in the universe you observe things that we consider to be the outcome of an evolutionary process. There isn't life everywhere, right? Even on the Earth, not all life looks the same. So it doesn't feel like that kind of idea would apply. It doesn't really feel like entropy, a thermodynamic, a so-called statistical law. So this is the idea that if you have a high-dimensional system that has many states, you'll tend to move away from any given state. Right? So this is sometimes the sort of the colloquial usage of it. Systems tend towards disorder. All that means is, if you're high enough dimensional, it's very hard to find any one state. And it's not really like that, because after all, here we are, and we're ordered. It doesn't feel as if that works alone. So there are other laws, like these ideal gas laws that are statistical. They represent relationships between pressure and temperature and volume. And you'll notice you can tweak temperature and pressure without violating the law. So that equality holds if you raise temperature just as long as you lower the volume, for example. Raise the volume. So there are, this doesn't tell you microscopically what you should expect, but it says that these general conditions should apply. Okay. So for the same energy in a room, if you make it smaller, you'll raise the temperature, that kind of thing. And it could be that there are things like that, ideal gas laws for evolutionary biology. And the canonical example of that, by the way, is kin selection. The modern formulation of kin selection has equalities that look a bit like that. The variables are things like relatedness and costs and benefits. They don't tell you what you observe in any given instance, but they say this is the general statement of what you expect. Okay, so now one of the things, okay, that comes out of laws and law-like statements, and this has been true in very well known in mathematics, but also true in physics, is the phenomenon of paradoxes. And so you'll know about real mathematical paradoxes like Gödel's incompleteness theorem and so forth, that arithmetic is fundamentally inconsistent. You might have read about such things. But there are, of course, paradoxes in physics too. You know, is light a particle or a wave? And this is the one you all learned in high school. And then there's the so-called twin paradox, where you travel through time and you meet yourself, this sort of stuff, that seem to fall out of the theories and laws of physics. And I sort of ask the question, well, okay, if there are law-like properties in evolution, and there's some kind of axiomatic foundation, and often these things are fundamentally inconsistent, they lead to paradox, are there paradoxes built into evolutionary theory that look a bit like this? And I'm going to disappoint you by saying not really. But there are some interesting weirdnesses, and I want to talk about them. And again, just to be clear, you know, I've been doing all this reading on educational reform, and lectures apparently don't work. All the data suggests that this thing we're doing now is a total waste of time, because even though you think you're listening to me and learning, you're actually not. And if you were to leave the room and someone asked you, what did he say? You'd say, well, he talked about paradoxes and things and laws. And that would be sort of the limit of what you'd acquired. And there's, you know, it's like that Woody Allen thing, right, where you did, I did the speed reading of War and Peace, and someone said, what was it about? Well, it was about the war. It was about Russia. Or Moby Dick was about a whale. And so, in some sense, fundamentally what I'm doing here is actually a mistake. So I don't mind being interrupted and you say no, and we digress, because it's ultimately not very valuable. Okay. So let's, this paradox thing. So when I say paradoxes, I mean it in this slightly more modest form than a mathematician might mean it, that there's some fundamental inconsistency. There's a slightly milder form of paradox, which is that, you know, you have some concept that seems reasonable, but it has consequences that seem fundamentally unreasonable. So it's a slightly weaker form of power. And then the reverse, right? Something that seems to be wrong doesn't make sense, actually does. In fact, that's interesting because there was an early debate on natural selection that the philosopher of science, Karl Popper, got involved in when he said that evolution was tautological. Survival of the fittest, what's the fittest, that which survives. We all know that's not true, but it felt like a tautology. And so that was a case where something that seemed self-contradictory turned out to actually not be the case, that there was a way of resolving it. So that's the instance of that one. That doesn't help me. Okay. So here are the sort of paradoxes I wanted to talk about. I realized actually every one of these is like a lecture. And in fact, it would be fun to teach a course on paradoxes of evolution, with each one of these being one. And I've got a ton of slides, and I'm just going to leave it to you, in some sense, to decide which ones you wanted to talk about. In the absence of that, I'll just proceed. And I'll stop. I thought, I was looking at it and thinking, oh God, I'll only get as far as that. Won't get there, but maybe you care about this. So let me just tell you what these are. So the first one some of you might have heard me talk about is I think that selection is an undetermined theory. In other words, we have to explain not just the origin of species, we have to explain the origin of selection. And I'll get to that. I think it's the most fundamental inconsistency in the theory, or missing component of the theory, because all of the models that we write down, or explanations we provide, posit the existence of the selection mechanism in advance. If you have two variants and the environment favors one over the other, then you will observe that one in the long term. Well, why does the environment favor one variant over the other? Is it physics, or is it another organism? And if it's another organism, well, that's under selection, too. So there's a kind of infinite regress built into the explanation that we need to deal with. I'm not saying it's an insoluble problem, but it's a problem. This one is having to do with complexity on Earth. You know, if there are trends towards building more complex things, and we can discuss what complexity means, why is it most stuff on Earth not complex? You know, the world is largely prokaryotic. They're happy. You know, is there a theory that would tell us why some lineages favor it over others? And it would be a bit like saying, you know, why not all lineages have wings, right? But it's not a problem for us. Some have wings, some don't. We're used to that idea, but we have a kind of idea of why wings might be favored after the fact, okay? Could we have an idea for why we might be favored after the fact? A predictive theory would be great. I don't think we're even close. This is a kind of interesting thing that pops out of the mathematics, that there is something like light speed in evolution, something I've spent a lot of time worrying about, in the same way that there's a fundamental limit to the velocity in physics. So there is such a thing as evolutionary light speed, and I'd like to talk about that because I like it, because I kind of nerd out on it. And these are interesting too. That one's interesting. Let me skip that for a second. I'll talk about that. Why aren't most things very simple? That might seem to be favored by natural selection. And these things which I'll skip, but maybe I won't if some of you or one of you is interested. And that is, you know, why is it, and this was a question that Dick Lewontin asked many years ago, Why is it that in the vast space of possible forms, we observe so few? Right? An artist could sit down and draw, in a second, a shape of an organism that does not exist on the planet Earth. Right? There's a vast number of possibilities. You know, things with legs coming out of their heads. There's lots of stuff you could imagine that we don't see. Why is that? And more profoundly, why is it it's all clustered? So if you project all that variability down onto some appropriate lower dimension, like a three-dimensional object is projected down into 2D in a shadow, why is it all clumpy? You know, there are sort of quadrupeds, right? And they're all sort of similar if you close your eyes. And they're all similar to me, because I'm not that good at taxonomy, right? I don't see the differences. You know, trees all look more or less the same. It's extraordinary that there's a... And it's a kind of funny bit I said. It's probably some kind of a heresy. But the point is that it's intriguing that a lot of variability goes unexplored by nature. Why? This is related to the first, and that's really this idea that you can't, the standard theory that Darwin provided, the tangled bank metaphor in the book, says that there's selection and there are adaptations, and they're different. Okay, and they change over different timescales. That selective pressures are out there in the world, adaptations are properties of the organism, and the organism evolves adaptations as a response to the world. But what happens when the selection pressures themselves are the adaptations? What happens when you build the world, which is what we've done? You can't separate them anymore. The organism-environment distinction seems inappropriate and approximate. And there is a theory, the theory of niche construction, that some of you might have heard of, that tries to deal with that, and that's something I've been concerned with. And the last one is somewhat more technical, and it's not even interesting to me. So let's just talk about this one. And again, I don't have answers here, right? I have a few models and ideas. I'm more than happy to be refuted or contradicted, or it doesn't matter to me. Okay. So here's the thing, right? Here's this extraordinary subterfuge of Charles Darwin, right? And I'm a fan, but it's just be clear about this subterfuge. So if you think about physics, right? When Newton was trying to explain gravity or how particles collide and bounce off each other, he could actually build models, and Galileo did that, right? You could say, look, imagine this marble is one planet, and this marble is another. And look what happens when they collide. They bounce off each other if it's an elastic collision. So there were models you could use to kind of illustrate your concept. So you could build, for example, an astrolabe. You could build a model of the solar system. And you could say, that's what I mean. That's what I mean when I'm talking about the solar system. What model could Charles Darwin have shown people that would be illustrative of natural selection? There isn't a model. I mean, you think, well, there was, of course. And he was smart enough to find it. And it was what breeders were doing. It's artificial selection. Because there's something you already know that's a model, meaning it's smaller in scale. That's all I mean by model. A mathematical model is, in some sense, an abstraction. The system you're studying means it's got fewer variables. This one had fewer variables. It was manipulable and so forth. So it's a model. And he said, the way it works is, and you guys know this, right? That pigeons, over the course of the generation of a breeder, or a few breeders, can be modified in a direction that we favor. So we are choosing things that we like based on some traits that we value, like their ability to navigate. And that's what natural selection does. Natural selection is replacing the conscious deliberative mind with forces of nature. But there's a problem with this. There's a problem with this metaphor. Because this thing is much more complicated than this thing. You see that? In order for that guy to be able to pick that guy, it needs to know stuff. It has to have knowledge. Now, again, I'm not being, there's no kind of hidden creationism coming at you, by the way, in case you're worrying. I'm just pointing out something that's obvious, is that this thing needs to be able to make a discrimination. It needs to be picked between A and B, or whatever it is. And it was interesting, actually, in the response to Darwin. I don't know how many of you know the history. There's not as much criticism of that model as there ought to have been. Because Darwin was actually using a supremely complex entity to explain a relatively simple trait. He was using the brains of breeders to explain the coloration of pigeons. It's kind of inverted. Science tries to do the opposite. It tries to explain complex things with simple forces, not simple forces with complex things. That's what religion does. Religion says, let's explain something as trivial as a human with something as complicated as a god, right? That's the fundamental weakness of religion in a scientific framework. It's overfitted to the data. What you really want is a parsimonious model such that you explain complicated things with simple things. That's what we do. That's our job. So this is the sort of problem with the thought experiment. It turns out to be actually a problem with the theory. I'll try and explain this. Now, some of you have seen these slides before. It turns out that more or less contemporary with Darwin worrying about this problem in biology, some physicists were worrying about this problem in physics, but in a different way. And it has to do with the second law, this remark that I made to you about systems tending towards disorder. Okay. And the usual way you talk about it, you might have taken this exam in whatever, at some point in your careers, when you say, okay, you have a volume, and you have on one side of the box hot things, and on the other side cold, and then you lift a lever up and you ask, what happens to the box? And the people who fail say, well, it gets hotter on one side and colder on the other. And you think, well, no, that's not the right answer. And the others say, well, it sort of all tends towards a constant temperature. And that would be the right answer, which slowly cools down, okay? And the reason why, of course, you all know is because the microscopic theory of heat says that heat is just the average velocity of particles. That's heat. What heat is. Okay. Heat is just a statistic, a macroscopic statistic defined over particle velocities. So this guy comes along and he says, you know, there's a way of actually messing up entropy. And you get this little guy, he's known as Maxwell's demon, and he actually can see the velocity of the individual particles. And when they're fast, he lets them through, say from right to left, and when they're slow, he lets them through from left to right. And so in time, he'll move that system out of equilibrium, right? He'll move it towards actually hotter on one side and colder on the other. So there's a way of having an intelligent agent that moves a system out of equilibrium. And that thought experiment, which seems extraordinarily simple, for 100 years, was one of the deepest thought experiments in statistical physics. It generated vast amounts of mathematics, and it generated the field of quantum computation. Okay. And so this was called Maxwell's intelligent demon. This is what Lord Kelvin said. He said, you know, for that to be true, to move a system out of equilibrium, that entity has to have a special power. It has to be inferential. And so you can see where I'm going, right? That natural selection is the same concept, slightly more complicated. So instead of having hot and cold particles, you have adapted and maladapted variants. Instead of having Maxwell's demon, you have Darwin's demon. And Darwin's demon is natural selection. And natural selection says, when things that work in the world, things that work in the world will be propagated, and things that don't work in the world will not. The environment has to make discriminations. It's unavoidable. Now you'll say, oh, it's fine, it's natural, it's just a distributed physical system. Fine, no disagreement. What's the theory of that? The way we do it now, for those of you who do mathematical genetics, for example, is you just write down viabilities. You write them down, you simply say, this thing gets this selection coefficient. That's not a theory of the selection coefficient, it's asserting it. I'm interested in deriving it. I just want you to understand the distinctions. So this is interesting. So we know that we can move a system from a state of disorder to order. So in this case, organisms that have adaptive traits. But we know we need something quite complicated to do it. So the question we can ask ourselves is, can we calculate the complexity of natural selection by looking at the object that it's selecting? Can we say something about the world by looking at the entities in it? Oh, and this is my little joke thing, where I put Wilberforce, who didn't like Darwin, up there, he doesn't make it. Because the Darwinian demon, who ultimately decides, as not the Pope, it doesn't propagate the Archbishop.
And presumably the Archbishop wouldn't propagate anyway, right? For other reasons. Unless he did it covertly. Okay, so so you can sort of think about this slightly mathematically, and I'm just going to throw this up here just so you can sort of see what I actually do. And it looks a little hairy if you're not familiar with this kind of notation. But think about it this way. Imagine you already started with sequences, like DNA sequences, and you just wrote them down and you aligned them. Is everyone here a biologist? So when I say it's aligning a sequence, I just take that, that's known to everybody. Okay. So so if you think about it, we all have this notion of highly conserved traits, right? And a conserved trait is a trait that doesn't vary much. That's how we sort of measure it. We look across lots of species that are separated by lots of time, and we see that they're all the same. So we think, ooh, something's going on that's interesting. Why is it interesting? Because you believe in entropy. Because entropy should make them not the same. We call that mutation in biology, but the underlying physics is the same. So when we see things that look the same, or more the same than we expect, we get interested. That's sort of the basic kind of intuition, right? And you can formalize that using information theory. You can simply measure the variability in a given position. And under mutation, what would you expect? Well, you'd expect what's called the equiprobable distribution. Everything should be equally likely. You'll see an A there, a C there, a T there. It doesn't matter because mutation wins, right? But if selection is winning, it should actually enforce uniformity at a site. So you can actually measure the strength of selection by just counting the uniformity at each site, and you do that just using these quantities. It doesn't really matter, you could do it a million different ways. So that's one way of trying to, and this is something that a number of people have done, to try and infer something about the complexity of the environment from the uniformity of a population of genomes.
David, would it be okay to interrupt you then?
Absolutely.
I got the sense you wanted that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but this, the complexity there that you're kind of measuring is not a single generation's worth of complexity.
No.
It's summed over the entire history that led you to those sequences.
Yes.
So at any one generation, you only need enough complexity to explain what might be a very simple binary choice.
That's true.
So you said that the pigeon example, you had a problem with it because it seemed that the selector needed to be more complex than the selectee, but the selector doesn't have to be that complex under Darwin's simple model of binary choices generation by generation.
It's a good point. The reason why in that case, it's, I don't know, again, I'm going to re-articulate it one more time so everyone gets it. So David's saying to me that in some sense, if complexity is measured cumulatively over many generations, all any one selective agent needs to be able to contribute is some tiny fraction of that. And so it wouldn't have to be as complex as the entire time series, right? And agreed. The problem with the pigeons is much of the evolution is taking place during the lifetime of a single breeder. And so in some sense, they actually do know, they do have the total complexity. Natural selection probably doesn't, well, absolutely doesn't have to have it. But the thought experiment, I think, is flawed because they actually do. In this case, it's clear that a given pigeon fancy knows exactly what they want and has the total time series in their head. But the objection holds. So I agree with the logic of what you're saying. I just think the pigeon fancier is a bad metaphor.
I guess, just to kind of come back then,
yeah.
In the pigeon fancier case, the complexity we're trying to explain is from the beginning of selection till the end of selection, the change.
Yeah.
How much more, and I don't know how much more complex pigeon, I mean, they've changed, but I think it's a little bit of an open question.
But that's the whole point.
Yeah, okay.
That's my hope. That this thing that's extraordinarily simple has changed very little under the force of something extraordinarily complex.
Okay.
That's the point.
Right.
But the general objection, I think he's absolutely right, that any given selective agent probably does only contribute a tiny fraction of the total complexity of the object. I think that's a key point. Yeah. Someone else want to? Laura.
So, is it necessary that the breeder has to be complex? I mean, now in the world of automation, you could think of a very simple computer program that.
Which I will do now.
Yeah.
It's critical. Okay, let's forget that. Let's just jump to Lawrence. So, another way to think about this is in terms of a very simple computer program. Imagine you were writing a very simple computer program,
And I gave you a series of bits, like numbers, like zeros and ones, okay? And I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you bits, and I'm not going to tell you which one's a zero and which one's a one. And let's say it's 10 bits long. And I want you to write a bit of code that from any initial configuration, of which there are 2 to the 10 of them, I want you to produce an output of a desired type. So I give you the output that I want. For example, I want the first 5 bits to be 1 and the last 5 bits to be 0. But I'm not going to tell you what the input sequence is. Okay? So, or whatever, something like that, an input-output match pair. So how would you actually do this? Well, what you would do is you'd sit down, it's a trivial bit of code, you could write in a few lines, you sort of look at each bit and you'd say, is that bit in the state that I want it to be in? If it's not, flip it. And if it is, leave it alone. And you just read through the sequence like that. And that's really easy. That's a simple bit of, right? But just think about that again. For every bit that you has a desired target, you, your program, has to scrutinize that bit. You see where I'm going with this? Now, if that bit you don't care about, that'll just go to that equiprobable distribution given by the mutation process. But for every bit you care about, you have to scrutinize it. You have to be an intelligent daemon for the bit. So this is just a picture of that, just making that point, that if you, here they are, here's selection. So it's kind of like a complementarity principle selection in this thought experiment. I want one of the first bit. I don't really care what happens there, but I do care what happens there and there. And so that's what happens. When you get there, you get, you know, with a large enough population with certain fluctuational error, equiprobable 0 and 1. Everywhere else you get what selection tells you to get. So this is the deep point, that natural selection, if it's like a simple computer program, has to have as many degrees of freedom in a sort of technical language as there are in the system that you study. For every bit that natural selection fixes, it has to be able to scrutinize that bit. Yes, please, yeah.
The temperature of the room requires an understanding of the velocity of every particle in the room?
No, it doesn't. Good point. So, this is a good point. So there are degeneracies in temperature, right? So, which means that there are multiple different configurations that all map to exactly the same temperature. And so that's called coarse graining. And that says that you only care the temperature is right, but you don't care how it's achieved. But that's just that, that then becomes your degree of freedom. Your appropriate dimensionality is in temperature, not the microscopic configurations of the particles. In other words, let me say that again in lots of different ways, that there you expect randomness. But at the level that you're observing, you expect order, because that's where you're imposing it. So whatever level you pick, and you can pick multiple different levels, that's the appropriate level for your degree of freedom. And beneath that, you get your randomness. Okay, that's a key notion, by the way, because that's absolutely true for phenotypes, right? There are lots of different ways of achieving the same, for example, tertiary structure of a protein fold. And you can get it with lots of different configurations. So they all map many to one. So they can be random with respect to the target, but there's only a small subset of them that have that property. So that's true. This is with respect to any observable, right, that you care about. The problem with this is, and it might not be a problem, but if it's not a problem, we need a theory for it, is that the thing that does the observing is itself disordering. So the pigeon fancier dies. And someone else takes over and says, you know, I don't like long tails, I like short tails. And so on. So what maintains the stability of the selection process itself? Does that do that? So in some sense, what that's maintained by is by another selection, meta-selection, on-selection, and so forth. Now, one way we solve that problem is we separate timescales. We say, actually, the rate at which you get change here is much faster than the change here. And so on. So think about, again, that thought experiment with the simple computer program. As long as this thing remains constant with respect to mutation here, it doesn't really matter, right? Because the bits that you care about have the right configuration, the bits that you don't, randomize. But if that thing itself is mutating, Well, then, in the end, what is the equilibrium distribution? It's the totally random distribution. There's no long-term order. Is that clear? You can't get, you're not allowed to posit an adaptive system that lives, that has a half-life of the of an electron. In other words, there's nothing permanent in biology. There is no long-term stability in biology. Anything that's ordered is ordered because it's there's a force being imposed on it to order it in some form. And it always wants to disorder. So you get this nested problem where you get an infinite regress that maybe is solvable by having multiple timescales, but then we need a theory of multiple timescales of selection. We don't have such a theory.
The point there about the environment selection, you're looking for a certain constancy, you're looking for continual selection in one direction.
Exactly.
But wasn't Darwin just saying, well, there is one thing we can imagine is always going to be favored, and that is, in a sense, maybe you view this as just as a tautology, but it is the reproductive capacity that there's always going to be.
That doesn't give you, unfortunately, complex states of order. You're right, at some level it might work for simple organisms, but if you have complicated, high-dimensional traits...
that will always correlate with reproduction.
That's true, but you need to now explain the source of the correlation.
Okay.
That's agreed. But it turns out that you're to create that sort of correlational structure requires something kind of interesting. For me to care that you having a nose and a brain and a brown shirt and whatever else gives you a high replication rate is an interesting problem in itself. And for that to be constant in time is a problem in itself. Not denying that that's not true. And it's kind of an interesting history, by the way, because it has a parallel in physics, because, the covalent bond wasn't discovered till the 20th century, right? And so the why are molecules stable was actually a really deep question, even over relatively short spans of time. And so this is what Schrödinger wrote about at length in this fantastic book you should all read, What is Life, where he ultimately explains the stability of matter at the level he cared about in terms of laws of physics, in fact, in terms of quantum mechanics, that there are discrete states of the world, and those discrete states in some sense contribute to stability at the molecular level. He thought biology needed a theory that would explain long-term stability of phenotypes, and I claim we don't have it. I'm delighted to see it. But I claim we don't have it. Okay. So I don't know, how do people feel about that? You okay? Buy it? Not? It's important because if a lot of people are just here to say, well, they don't really question it. They don't question natural. They'll sort of sit down. They'll say, I study my flowers, or I study my insects, or I study, and somehow what we've got is sufficient, and I can do phylogenies, and I can. But wait a minute, is it sufficient? And at this point you should be aware that the theory hasn't reached a state of perfection, right? It needs some work. That's the sort of flavor of what I want to tell you. And you might not buy it, but then I'd like to see the theory. Here's another one, right, which is, why are some things big and complicated and some things really small and simple? Does anyone know? I'm of interest. Does anyone in this room who is a biologist and interested in evolution have any idea why the world is made up of things like prokaryotes and large multicellular organisms, other than by chance? That's kind of amazing, right? Do you really not know? It's like, here we are in the 21st century, and we have no idea why life has complicated forms of life on it, why the Earth. Isn't that interesting? Or am I missing something?
I'm willing to wave my hands a lot and say that the complicated interactions between mutation, which is random, and selection, and recombination, and then mix in the environment with migration.
This is the absolute non-answer, right?
But I'm willing to wave my hands and say that the combinations between those things produce that. But if you try to pin me down and say, well, so how exactly would this be produced, and what were the exact historic forces that led this to this, then I would have to say, well, Yeah, I hope that this will be worked out. Or
ouch.
Ouch.
No, but that's interesting, right? Because that's an ouch answer for me, because either you're saying, you know, in the end, give up. Because those things that we observe are probably sufficient. I'm a materialist too in this sense. I don't think there are special magical forces. So those ingredients clearly are important. But you are suggesting to me that an answer would just be what historians call a chronicle. A sort of bit-by-bit description of the history that culminated. It's not a, that's not a theory of anything, right? That's just a description. It's like, you know, the Archduke Ferdinand was shot by princeps in such, right? And this happened, and then Second World War happened, and then so on and so forth. And agreed. I mean, that would be, for me, that's a description, not a scientific theory. That's a return to natural history.
But there will be the equations
okay.
that will govern these things, and that's what I would refer to
okay.
as the theory. Now, even with the Maxwell's demons and
yeah.
thermodynamics, I mean, we have laws of thermodynamics, and we consider them to be the guiding principles, even though these laws cannot predict the precise
yeah.
Position of every atom in the system at any given point.
Right. So you're right. Okay. So you're saying something like the first example I gave of the ideal gas law, which was somehow your question too, which is so long as the equality is respected, the particular details of what the pressure is, or what the volume is, or what the temperature is, we can't know that, but we can know the quality has to be respected. So we have to find something like a statistical law that's respected, even though the particular details of it we can never, ever infer. It's interesting, it's pessimistic, but maybe true. In fact, many biologists feel that.
Would you take another stab?
So
here with the other stab, you would
yeah.
say, which is not to say that there's anything that's wrong, you
yeah.
can get these lower levels,
yeah.
but that if your model was as follows, that life evolving, that transitions in complexity, jumps of levels of organization are rare. They're rare, but they do happen. So over time, you're going to have multiple lineages exploring evolutionary space. De facto, they start simple. As a matter of a rare event, once in a while, lineage will transition over one of these quantum leaps. So it's taking a quantum explanation kind
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
into another level of complexity. Some will go extinct. But if you wait long enough, you're going to get a few lineages that have persisted long enough to have gone over a couple of these hurdles.
So it's a kind of random walk.
It's
the
random
walk model.
Starting from simplicity.
Yeah, and there are many, and there are models like that. I mean, I don't know. For me, I don't know why, and I have to think why I find it unsatisfactory. In some sense, it just says, look, if you have available to you complexity and simplicity, that's in the state space, and you're able to make transition between them, that's true, and your process is sort of ergodic, then yes, you'll explore complex as well as simple things. Somehow, and maybe I'm wrong, it feels to me as if you're putting in the solutions in the states, into the model, because you're saying complexity exists as a possible state that you can randomly walk to. And then somehow, by some process I don't understand, those complex traits are favored and propagated, so, right? I think that those models might be consistent with the data. I'm not sure they're fully explanatory, because in a way they don't really explain the origin of anything, because you assert the existence of those states and just move between them. That's where I feel uncomfortable. It's not that I think it's, fundamentally flawed. I'm not sure it constitutes an explanation for me.
The Maynard Smith kind of answer is that there
yeah.
is that those transitions which are rare involve another level of organization, a self-assembly of another level of complexity,
yeah.
of replication hierarchy.
Okay.
So would that be better then?
It would, but there, again, that's interesting.
More,
you need more, and there would be a kind of theory we would need. Something like that. Sorry, yes.
Yeah. So without even knowing how you get to this part of the search space,
yeah.
one thing you need to postulate and prove that is that those states are more stable. And this is, I think, getting at the
exactly.
point you're going to make, that the extra complexity allows you to search through the space more effectively. And so you end up building on itself. But that doesn't answer the question of how you initially jump those levels of
and moreover though and they're by virtue of being more complex in some sense they're also less stable, right?
They got more parts.
In that,
more ways of going wrong.
Together, more ways of going wrong.
So, okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that now, but in a very specific case. And because it's a case where actually people have done science, it's more than philosophy, this discussion. People actually have done science on this question, and you know it. Here's the philosophy, though. And so, this is kind of a famous Jesuit, who I don't really like very much. I mean, I know some evolution people really love him, I don't. And actually, I've read that book, and it's awful. And but essentially, you'll see this omega here, right? And that, and the basic idea there is that the universe, he actually didn't understand physics, it's kind of neat. The universe is actually tending towards a state of perfect order. And in fact, it turns out the absolute opposite is true, right? That we're all gonna end up little motes of dust somewhere, right? That's our long-term future, in one of many ways. Because entropy in the universe is increasing, unfortunately. Won't matter to us. Right? Because we'll blow the hell out of ourselves long before entropy kills us. So that, and I'm talking, you know, many billions of years, so no problem. So, but he claimed it did. And so, and there is this kind of idea, and many people have had it, that there's something built into the laws of nature such that somehow, along the lines that maybe David was sort of getting at, right, there are these processes that will jump between states that are self-stabilizing and becoming more complicated and, you know, that's sort of an implicit part of what you said. So the question is, you know, if you go back to the source, is there something like that in it? I mean, is there evidence of trends in the basic theory? And it's interesting, so there have been experiments, and here's some examples of the kind of trends people find. You just look at the data, they're very trivial. So this is from Rick Lenski's experiments. He does all these neat experiments with prokaryotes where he does serial passage, so he grows them in a petri dish, and then he picks one out and sticks it in another petri dish and lets it grow, and then picks it out and lets it grow. So he's sort of doing evolution in real time with prokaryotes. And he'll do something like this. He'll say, here's time, here's comparative fitness. So what happens is you compete a descendant against his ancestor in terms of the growth rate. Right, so you have them growing here, you do all this serial pattern, you take this one, you say, how do you fare against your ancestor? And that's what this ratio is. Right, when you're parity of one, you're doing equally well, but as you move along in time, and you have more and more generations, it turns out you can outcompete your ancestor, right? In this environment. So, you know, we know, what's that saying? It's saying, guess what? Evolution works. Evolution by natural selection works. It works in a fixed environment. The way I like to think about this, there's latent capacity for adaptation. That's what's interesting about this result. It's the only thing that's interesting about this result. There's a bit of room, there's wiggle room for improving over nature if you hold things constant. That's kind of interesting, right? And he does this thing too where it's the same result really, but it's not a relative measure, it's an absolute measure, where you look at the growth rate of the ancestor and the growth rate of the derived lineage. Okay, so it's not a competition experience, just absolute terms. And you see the same kind of results. And it's interesting, this gets tons of press, this work, showing that evolution actually works. Is that really surprising? I mean, I like him. I mean, I know him. He's a buddy. But I have to ask myself, why is it getting so much press? We're just showing us that natural selection can work. Sort of odd to me. A slightly more, I actually think, more profound experiment was done in experimental evolution earlier by this guy, Saul Spiegelman. And this is what he did, and it's sort of kind of neat. So he was interested in viruses that infect bacteria, phage, and he did the same kind of experiment in a chest tube, but he threw in with the virus a protein that the virus needs to replicate. So instead of the virus having to encode it itself, he gave it to them. So it's like me saying to you, here's a GPS, you go and rent a car, don't worry about using your brain. What happens in the long run? Well, the idea is that we lose our ability to navigate. We become, you know, is Google making us stupid? Question, right? And obviously it is. Right? And in fact, and here's the sort of experiment, right? So you give it what it normally would need to produce itself, for long enough, and after time, it's thrown away all those genes it normally would encode for the replicators. It doesn't need them, because it gets them from the environment. Okay. And this was actually, I think, a very neat experiment. It was evolution in action over the course of the lifetime of one biochemist, showing a tendency towards simplicity. So, which is, I think, a clue here. It's saying when the states of the world are certain, you don't really need to encode them endogenously. So it looks like we might have the beginnings of a theory here having to do with environmental uncertainty being the clue to why you build things that are complicated. So here's a little kind of pseudo-mathy diagram that I throw up just to make this point. It's non-complicated. It just says there's some number of genes that a virus needs to complete its life cycle. Let's call that N. It just needs them. It doesn't really care where they come from. So it's like a Venn diagram. They think they'd be encoded by the virus, they can be encoded by the host, or they can be encoded by both. And where does evolution take us? So like the replicase example. Well, it could say, you know, one possibility is that the virus throws it away, like Spiegelman, become minimal. Because, you know, you're going to give it to me. I'm not going to bother learning how to multiply or do long division because I can do it on my phone. So you become minimal. And the other possibility is you become what I call autonomous. You say, no, actually, you do want to do it because somehow I can't be sure that you'll do it for me. It's pretty obvious, right? And you can write down some mathy things to explain that. Skip. And something kind of interesting pops out of this. I'll just quickly just explain this. And sorry about this. It's really hard to read. But just basically it's saying that if there's some probability that the virus encodes a gene, let's say it goes from 0 to 1, and there's some probability that the host encodes a gene, and let's say that goes from 0 to 1. What this landscape is saying is that if the host encodes the gene, the virus should evolve on that landscape, which is a landscape of increasing fitness, to throw it away. Okay? So the interesting thing that comes out of these models is, asymptotically, everything you give a virus causes the virus to diminish. So the way that you would evolve a virus out of existence is give the virus everything it needs. Now this sounds kind of weird. And in fact, there were early attempts to treat virus infection by giving the virus everything it needed. It's like, no! So, you know, it's like these people here who build flu viruses, you know, it's like one of the things that's ethically questionable. You could say, yes, the theory says it should work in some cases. But it's not clear that we really want to try this out. Turns out, by the way, that the other thing works too, that if there's a threshold level of environmental uncertainty, where the virus grows to be autonomous, where it becomes complicated. And so this, I think, is a clue to some of these transitions. It's got to be some theory of environmental variability that we're after. I would put this up as a kind of funny thing for Taylor de Chardin fans, that the omega point, the real omega point, for virus evolution is zero. Okay. Which is sort of weird that you'd evolve into nothingness. I think it's kind of zen. How are we doing here? Maybe we've been going on a long time. I'm just going to tell you things now, because I realize that... I just want to give you a set flavor for some of these paradoxes and not give you any of the detail. Evolutionary light speed is cool, and I'll show you one slide that it's kind of neat. You've seen this, and I always say to people they've seen it because either they're physicists who've worked in general relativity, or they've watched Star Trek episodes, right? And the basic idea behind these kinds of pictures is that there is some space with certain units of space, and there are, so in light seconds, for example, in physics, and then there's time, seconds, for example. And light moves at the speed of light in a vacuum, right? And so if this is in dimensions of units of light seconds and seconds, then the diagonal there is the speed of light, velocity of light in a vacuum. You can't go any faster than that. That's what bounds this. It turns out, right, that in physics, the neat thing about physics, it says that anything outside of the so-called light cone can't be in your causal future. You can't influence things in the future that would require that you move faster than the speed of light, causally. And the same is true in the past. Nothing in the past that lies outside of your past light cone can influence you in the present. And this theory has all sorts of neat and beautiful paradoxes that pop out of it. It turns out you can actually derive a very similar result for evolution here. It seems kind of weird, but I'm just going to throw it up. And I drew this one, so you can see the difference. It's kind of beautiful, this one is done. It's got little bits that stick out at the top, and just doesn't have the elegance of the physics example. But what you do is you actually just twist it, and you say that there's the units of space are now space and mutations per genome, and the units of time are generational time. So that's the appropriate mapping, if you like. And it turns out you can derive, and for those who are interested, I'll put a paper up at the end, you can derive the maximum velocity of evolution. Based on the principle, and the intuition is that there's a certain velocity beyond which all information is lost. So it's like entropy. If you turn the mutation rate up too high, selection can't keep hold. The demon gets confused. I don't know what to do anymore. And that's the basic intuition. So there is a rate at which no information can be propagated biologically. And that's evolutionary light speed. That's kind of cool. So I got into that. Blah, blah, blah. There's lots of mathy bit there. And let me just show you why I'm going to stop, because I think there's so much stuff here. But I'm going to show you one other side because I think it's kind of cool. And it has to do with phenotypes. That point I opened with. Why are there only a few phenotypes in the world? Why is it, and I'll show you in a second, when, you know, Captain Picard, or what's the other one? Captain Kirk, goes to a planet, he can always mate with whatever he encounters.
And talk to them,
and that's right, and then and so forth. And it's sort of interesting, and the question is that just silly, makes for good TV, or is it true? And there should be a theory that tells us how much variability we expect under certain variational processes. And I think there are. I think there are such theories. And I'm not going to tell you today, but I'm just going to show you some pictures. So the way I think about it, Apple versus, not Apple now, Apple in the good old days of Apple, right? Before Apple became a kind of multinational evil empire, when actually you could wear your Apple badge with pride, because you were a member of a population of elite, countercultural activists. And now, where it's just a badge of conformity. That's actually worrying to me, I don't know how to do that. But what was the interesting property of Apple versus Microsoft? And it's this, right? Apple was small, and it explored an extraordinary space of variation. It made iPods, right? It makes iPads, it makes computers, it makes a kind of cool operating system, it makes other stuff too, I know what it makes. You guys turn it, I forgot. And so it's tiny, but explores a vast space of possibilities. Microsoft was vast, but just pushing out the same thing every time, right? Windows 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, all of which are inferior versions of the preceding. Okay, you see, I'm indoctrinated, I still have that kind of Apple radicalism. And it turns out that you can actually write down a theory that says that when you're really big, you produce more of something, but the more that you produce is the same. But when you're small, you produce less of something, but it's more variable. Another way to think about it, and it's interesting, it's a problem that I have now in my role at the WID. Here I am at a big state university, and you'd think that I have access to all you brilliant people, and if I just mobilize you, I can do extraordinary things because there are so many of you. Whereas where I was before at the Santa Fe Institute, I only had like 25 people. But why is it that the Santa Fe Institute did so much, so variably, at its scale, and it feels on certain bad days here as if everyone's telling me no. Okay? It's bureaucracy, right? Bureaucracy is a force in society, a set of constraints that have to be built and actually in some sense serve a function, but at the same time the positive side has a negative side, which is you're constrained. There are things you just can't do. And it's actually a theory of genomic bureaucracy that I want. I want a theory that says that as a system gets larger in scale, because there are more things that are interacting, it becomes harder to change any one thing without changing everything. That's the intuition for the theory. It turns out you can actually formulate such a theory for genomes. That's that bit, which I thought was kind of cool. And I just want to show you this. Gould talked about all this stuff, but I just want to show you my one picture, which is, oops, this one, which is just illustrating that remark that I made about, you know, it's just sort of, with a few exceptions, everything, this is actually from the original Star Trek, everything that, you know, this ludicrous sort of, everyone that Kirk met was basically, you know, Piggy Man and all that, compatible with him in some sense. So with a few exceptions, like the Tribbles, I don't know, you know, whatever, and that kind of intelligent space snot down there. So that's something I'm interested in. And the final one I'll tell you about, which I think is cool, is what a lot of people have been interested in, which is, in some sense, the idea that, like I was saying to begin with, we need to explain the origin of selection. And the way they do it is through the theory of niche construction. That, in fact, organisms build extended phenotypes. They build their environments. And the environment then feeds back to select them. But there's this weird thing where you're lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps because you're building the selective force itself. And this is actually an interesting problem. And so I'm intrigued by that. And I'll finish, if I can find it, with this movie. I don't know if this will be loud enough. So this is an example of niche construction by spiders. It's just so funny, well, I like it. And I'm not sure you can hear it, but I'll end on a good note.
The most accomplished of all web-building species. Recently, scientists gave these tiny creatures a variety of psychoactive drugs to observe their effects on web-building. When given a minute dose of LSD, the spider's web took on an unfamiliar, minimalist structure.
Can somebody turn the lights down?
By given caffeine, the web structure was not affected, but the spider's behavior was. Given THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, the spider didn't build a web. Where it lay all day and watched the caffeine spider go.
Anyway, that'll do it. Yeah. Thank you.